it's a crisis. There is a crisis for shortages of enough feed for the livestock.
A severe drought in the interior creates a hay shortage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a health clinic that serves the poor in Juneau may close its doors.
I'm pretty outraged at how a whole population is going to be, they're on the street to begin with, but they're going to be thrown out even deeper.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The highest-ranking leader in the United States Coast Guard stopped in on Alaska today to talk about Arctic strategy. Commandant Admiral Robert Papp hosted a town hall meeting with city officials and leaders from the local Native Corporation. Unalaska has a deep-water port that's ice-free all year, even though the Coast Guard has discussed building similar resources closer to the Arctic in Nome or Kotzebue. Papp said that could be a long way off.
The only deep water port that we can rely upon is Dutch Harbor. That's a long logistics line when you're working up off Barrow. But most of my ships, we can't get in any other place other than Dutch Harbor.
Papp says oil drilling has gotten a lot of attention, but the shipping industry is growing much faster.
I'm more worried about traffic concentration coming through the Bering Strait because, as you well know, those ships carry millions of gallons of bunker C and other fuels, and that is the more likelihood of a disaster than drilling for oil right now.
Papp says the Coast Guard is focusing on creating mobile response units rather than dedicated bases to respond to increased activity in the Arctic. That means replacing the aging 378 Cutter series with a new class of vessels. Papp's visit was part of a larger tour of Alaska. The severe drought that's gripped the interior for most of the summer finally broke over the weekend. Rain fell throughout the region for the first time in some areas since early July. But it's probably too little and too late for most farmers, especially those who own livestock, who are having to resort to costly measures like irrigating and importing hay from Canada and the Lower 48. Tim Ellis has the story.
The rain cleared the air of smoke from the Mississippi wildfire still smoldering near Delta, but it didn't bring much relief to the area's farmers. Bryce Wrigley is a Delta barley grower and president of the Alaska Farm Bureau, and he says this difficult season started with the opposite problem, cold, wet weather that delayed planting.
We actually started planting on the day we normally quit, and so it was just that late. I mean, on the 17th of May, we had snow.
The cool spell was followed by a stretch of 90-degree days in early June. Other than a couple of rains earlier in the summer, pretty much the only water that's fallen onto the area's farmlands has come from irrigation systems, like the one that Doug McCollum set up on about 300 acres of hay east of town. A few miles away at the family's meatpacking plant, McCollum's daughter, Jeannie, sums up the economic toll that this summer's drought is taking on the business.
All I can say is it's a crisis. There is a crisis for shortages of enough feed for the livestock.
Jeannie McCollum says the business tries to maintain a 2-year supply of hay for their 400 head of cattle and sell the surplus to horse owners around the state to cover the cost of fertilizer, which runs to about $100,000 a year. That's the sort of savvy that's helped them to do pretty well in a business where the profit margins are always slim. This year, the McCollums are just trying to grow enough to avoid hauling in hay from Canada and the Lower 48, a costly fallback plan that many other farmers in the interior have had to resort to, along with others in the Mat-Su Valley, which also has been hard hit by drought.
It's cost prohibitive with the price of fuel to run to Canada, you know, to get feed. Potentially, you know, at some point, maybe some of these other people that produce hay, that some of them are only getting, you know, a third of what they normally get. It's a fair chance that, you know, some of the you know, other people that are producing hay might have to tell their clients that, hey, you're going to have to find another source to get your hay.
But another Delta area farmer, Don Lintelman, is already bringing in truckloads of feed for the 120 cows that provide milk for his Northern Lights Dairy, one of two in the state. Lintelman, who's farmed in the area for 44 years, says it's very expensive, but he has no choice.
Well, we got over 600 acres, and we only probably got about a fourth of the crop we normally get.
Phil Caspari, the agricultural extension agent with the UAF Cooperative Extension Service in Delta, is working with Lintelman to help him get a low-interest loan to help offset the cost of buying imported feed. Caspari says Lintelman, on Friday, became the first Alaska farmer this season to be given assistance through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Conservation Reserve Program. Caspari believes agency officials approved Lintelman's requests and likely will grant others because they've realized the impact of this year's drought.
It seems to really be coming to light more and more that we have to take some action to avert a real disaster.
This summer's drought has also been hard on farmers cultivating other crops, both in the interior and to a lesser extent in the Matsu Valley, the state's other major agricultural area. Francie Havemeister, the director of the State Division of Agriculture, says that because the Tanana Valley has gotten less than half of the usual summer rainfall, farmers here are harvesting less than a third of their average yield. And she says that has hurt them economically.
When you're looking at a yield of 30%, you're looking at a drastic shortfall when it comes to revenue.
Havemeister says she agrees with the gloomy prediction that farmers here have already drawn, that the weekend rains, while welcome, are just too little, too late. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Pioneer Mountain looms over a small, anonymous white building tucked away on Palmer's Bodenburg Loop. Although the mountain and surrounding fields seem to dwarf the tiny structure, the research going on inside it could have gigantic implications for agriculture in the Matanuska Valley. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
That's the potato greenhouse. We do have apple trees in this enclosure.
Peggy Hunt is a born educator. She's an agronomist. That's a person who applies scientific principles to crop production. And she is director of the state's Plant Materials Center, located a few miles from downtown Palmer. On this unusually hot July day, she's leading me around the center and its grounds.
We're looking at, in our country, in our world, you know, climate change. Are we going to have seeds? Do we need seeds for survival?
Few of us pay attention to the tiniest of agricultural necessities, but the Plant Materials Center makes seed cultivation and preservation its business. In one respect, the center functions as a place that preserves, catalogs, and stores seed for future use.
This is a place where we have saved those seeds. Just what we have in here, at least, are the native plants, the forestry seeds.
The center is one of 27 in the United States. Each one is responsible for a distinct region. All of them, except Alaska's, are federally funded. Ours is funded by the state. It's the center's job to ensure that seed provided to local farmers is not only 100% pure, but has a guaranteed high germination rate.
Here's some more screens. Again, this would go for a different size machine. Such as this, you can have two or three different...
Hunt leads me to another building, this one full of odd-looking contraptions. They are seed separators. Some use air, others strainers to separate out the unwelcome seed. They give the room the look of a giant's kitchen. Dozens of screens, strainers, and colander-like gadgets hang from the walls. They can separate out the one noxious weed seed from the thousands and thousands that fill a bag of lettuce seeds.
Here, they've got it written on here, 23 pounds. This is nugget, which is...
Pure seeds are bagged, weighed, and stored. But how do we know the seeds will sprout?
This is Lubo Malov.
Lubo, yes.
Oh, hi.
Good to meet you.
Yeah, and what are you doing in here?
Well, this is the seed lab.
To make sure that seeds actually sprout, not fizzle out, researchers at the center put them through germination tests. That's Lubo Malov's job. He works in the state seed research lab.
Germination test, we test 400 seeds. Mm-hmm. And, there are like four reps of 100 seeds. So there is one right here. And this looks like Senecio. It is called beech fleabane. It required 1 week of pre-chill.
Lubo pulls one germination sample out of a storage unit that is heat and light controlled to mimic actual day and night fluctuations in outdoor temperature and light. Twice a year, the center sells seeds it deems 100% pure. The seed, by law, must be tested within 18 months of sale.
And you know, that helps the seed producers so they can get the highest price for their seed, and also helps the customer, because when you buy seed, you want to buy seed that will grow.
Just outside the lab, green fields spread for 200 acres. Irrigation sprinklers hiss on the fields of hay and grasses that are being grown to provide even more seeds for research, cleaning, and sale. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Tlingit teenager searches for berries and her heritage.
You show no fear. Don't be afraid to walk into the berry patch and get it, because that's where all the good ones are. It's deep in the middle, and you have to kind of fight for them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
Juneau's Front Street Clinic is in danger of shutting down due to fiscal reasons. The public health facility run by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium caters to the capital city's homeless and low-income residents. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
Up to 25 people a day visit Front Street Clinic to receive medical, dental, and behavioral health services. 59-year-old veteran Michael Needham is one of them. He's having impressions made for dentures.
They're very thorough with what they're doing, and I thank God every day for them.
Needham has been going to the clinic for 3 years and likes the way the staff treats him.
Like, I'm special right now, this is your time, you know, and that's just what it's all about. They don't get interrupted or nothing. It's a really cool way they do that.
Needham also has cancer.
See these things? These little red dots are all cancer spots, and I've been coming here for them.
Janet Brewster is Front Street Clinic manager and medical provider. She says the health condition of clinic patients range. Some of them are very ill, with diabetes, high blood pressure, lung disorders, or cancer.
Without Front Street, undoubtedly some of these folks will die because they're not going to have the day-to-day care that we can help them with.
Search Communications Director Michael Jenkins says the possibility of shutting the clinic down is based on federal budget cuts, including sequestration, as well as a reorganization of the Regional Health Consortium. 10% of Front Street patients are Alaska Native. They can go to searches at the Lund Medical Center if the clinic closes. Brewster doesn't know where the others will go.
We have a very small number of patients that do have full disability services. We'll be able to find other doctors in town that can take them. The largest portion will end up without medical care at all.
Dentist Ed Linzel has been practicing at the clinic for nearly all 10 years of its operation. He says Front Street staff members are determined to do what it takes to keep the clinic open.
I'm pretty outraged at how a whole population is going to be, they're on the street to begin with, but they're going to be thrown out even deeper.
The group of search employees has taken their fight to various people and organizations, including the Juneau Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. Dan Austin is a founding member.
We consider this to be the most important immediate issue for us. And so we will play whatever role we possibly can to keep Front Street Clinic open, whatever it takes.
Clinic manager Jana Brewster says it's her duty to tell the patients about Front Street's possible closure. As soon as patient James Bouchard heard, he immediately started a petition. Within a week, he already had 500 signatures.
I'm going to try and gather as many signatures as I can because, you know, not only me who's needed help, but people that require daily medications and stuff that won't be able to get it if the Front Street closes.
Search's Michael Jenkins says the board of directors will decide at an upcoming meeting whether Front Street Clinic stays open or shuts down. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
As Alaska's summer starts to slide toward fall, concern is growing for sheltering the increasing numbers of homeless citizens in Anchorage on cold nights. Ellen Kersnack is the Community Relations Coordinator for Catholic Social Services, the agency that runs the Brother Francis Shelter in the city. Beans Cafe is across a parking lot from Brother Francis. Kersnack says Beans is a day shelter and serves breakfast and lunch. Brother Francis handles the evening meal and provides a safe place to sleep, but often more beds are needed, and Beans has provided sleeping space. Federal money that was administered by the municipality of Anchorage has dried up, and without it, Kersnack says, the overflow numbers of homeless who need a bed on cold nights won't be able to sleep at Beans.
So what we do at Brother Francis is we pay for a staff person to go over to Beans, and we pay Beans to utilize the space at night. So we utilize these funds through the Muni that were federal funds that were passed through. So we utilize that money to pay a staff person to go over and be the supervisor, essentially, and to pay Beans for the use of the space.
How much money are we talking about that's needed?
$71,000. We utilize that for two winters. So it's pretty economical. I mean, when you think about how many people have been housed there during the winter months at night.
How has the need changed in the last 5 to 10 years? What are you seeing?
Well, our numbers are certainly up. They're up this fiscal year. We're up to, just this past fiscal year, 3,700 plus. So that's quite a few individuals. That's unduplicated individuals. We attribute that to the cost of housing in Anchorage. People come in from all over the state. They come in from the lower 48, and the individuals homeless in Anchorage has really increased tremendously over the last 5 years.
So you've been spending about $35,000, maybe a little more than that, per season to help house these overflow people in need. What happened to that funding that you were getting?
The federal funding that the municipality had to distribute in this manner has gone away. We have not had a chance to meet with the Muni yet to discuss it in detail so that we can have a plan for this winter. But that's a grave concern of ours because we're unable to continue to operate the overflow, which has a maximum capacity of 124 people. And again, we utilize this space from October through May. So we are very concerned about what will happen to those people if that funding goes away. And so there's not a good plan coming up for winter. And it's, you know, I don't know what the temperature was last night, but it can get cold in August. So it can be an immediate problem, but certainly a problem in a month from now.
Ellen Kersnack is the Community Relations Coordinator for Catholic Social Services. Anchorage Health and Human Services Director Janet Wittmeyer says the problem of coming up with shelter funding for Anchorage's homeless citizens is not a new topic. Wittmeyer says there are others in the community who have volunteered to provide services that Catholic Social Services would normally have to pay for. She declined to name who those volunteer organizations are. If overflow shelter is not available at Beans Cafe this winter, homeless people would have to leave the area of Brother Francis and Beans to find warm beds on cold nights in other parts of the city. Transportation is not provided by any entity at this point. Wittmeyer says people seem to figure it out.
Oh, I guess I can answer that with, we have people that stay at like Gospel Rescue Mission, and that's not in that area. So somehow they find a way to find a warm place to sleep at night.
Wittmeyer says the mayor considers the issue of safe shelter for the homeless a priority, but a meeting with organizers who advocate for the poor, including Catholic Social Services, has not yet been scheduled.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Wintry weather is forecast to sweep across Arctic Alaska. National Weather Service meteorologist Scott Berg says a deep low-pressure system is sending cold air down over the North Slope and Brooks Range, ushering in conditions atypical of mid-August.
Generally, it would bring just rain, but this is really cold, and we're going to actually see some snow up along the North Slope that could possibly affect the Dalton Highway and the passes through the Brooks Range with a couple inches of snow.
The northwestern Brooks Range can expect up to 2 inches, while up to 5 are forecast for the northeastern portion of the range, including Anaktuvik and Attigan passes. No snow is expected to the south, but Berg says the interior will get some rain. Berg says a high-pressure ridge that dominated interior weather for much of the summer has pushed off to the east, allowing systems to move across the state. The town of Wrangell, once called the Sleeping Giant, has seen an awakening of its native culture and history. It began with the Sheikh's Tribal House rededication in May. Last month, it hosted both a National Traditional Foods Conference and a Tlingit basketball camp for kids. In early August, a group of people headed to the original Tlingit settlement 25 miles from present-day Wrangell for a language and culture camp. It was the first time Tlingit was spoken in Old Town in 65 years. KSDK's Shady Grove Oliver has the story.
19-year-old Sarah Williams Churchill is leading me into the middle of the forest.
You show no fear. Don't be afraid to walk into the berry patch and get it. Because that's where all the good ones are. It's deep in the middle, and you have to kind of fight for them.
We're surrounded by tall spruce trees, and we're doing what she does best. Hunting for salmon berries.
It's the little things in life, and for me, it's berries.
She's one of about 15 people at a culture camp on southern Wrangell Island. The purpose is to perpetuate elders' traditional knowledge of Wrangell. Virginia Oliver is the camp coordinator.
Chateya, it's me, Virginia Oliver. Chateya, Chwantlenya, Chatduasak. I was born and raised in Wrangell.
Along with teaching about traditional foods and crafts, Oliver wants the camp to focus on language.
It's my dream to speak the language, to not let it die. I believe that the language is the foundation of our culture. It's who we are.
Oliver invited two elders to come and teach. Both are fluent speakers of Tlingit.
My name is Florence Mark Shakely.
My name is Ruth Demert, and I'm from Cake.
The first evening, the campers sit around in a circle and introduce themselves. Shakely says this is important, both linguistically and culturally.
And they have to find out for themselves what clan they are, what child they are, and who their grandparents are, and this is education for them. And after they learned all this, then they realize they do have a place in the community, they do belong somewhere, and this gives them pride.
Sarah Williams Churchill thinks her Tlingit name is Kwaksik, but she's not sure what it means or if she's even pronouncing it right. She got her name from her grandmother, the last Tlingit speaker in her family.
Yeah, I got my first and my middle name from her. I got her Tlingit name, and she meant a lot to me. I guess it's kind of like she passed away before we could figure it out.
So, for the last 10 years, she's been searching for the meaning of her name.
My mom tried, but she herself didn't know a lot of it.
The number of Tlingit language speakers plummeted in the 20th century. A 2000 UNESCO study estimated fewer than 300 fluent speakers left. And that was 13 years ago. Ruth Demmert has seen the change.
I'm not too sure. I think you call it progress. In order to progress in the society nowadays, English was enforced. And along the way, people got lost and start just to speak English. I think it's important that it's being reintroduced because we do not want to lose our language.
And Sarah wants to find her name, so she asks the elders for help.
When we first met her, the way she was saying it just didn't sound right. So Ruth and I had her saying the name over and over.
Shakely says that sometimes when a name is spelled, important sounds are left out.
They were taught how to say it like this, and maybe they couldn't pronounce the sounds that they heard either, and that changes the name completely. But we finally came across what we thought they meant.
Like her grandmother before her, her name is Berry Basket Daughter.
And now that I know what our name meant, it changed my life. And it almost broke my heart.
And she says knowing her name is only the beginning of learning her identity.
Kuksik Yuhat Duasak. 10 years of pronouncing it wrong. I was at the point of thinking this is something that might not ever be found, and then to go to culture camp and find it. All that searching's done, what do I do now? I figure out the rest of myself. I figure out my lineage. I figure out how to speak it and how to be it.
I heard that we'll never not be anything than who we are, Tlingit people. It will never go away.
Virginia Oliver says experiences like this culture camp strengthen a community as a whole. Through the camp, she and the elders have created a Tlingit phrase of the week to air on the radio in Wrangell. Demmert says she thinks the future now holds promise.
You know, our culture will survive if the language is included. We feel that this is really important.
And she hopes it will only get stronger with each generation to come. Reporting in Wrangell, Askutu, Chik I, Yuhatduasak. Or in English, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Tim Ellis in Delta, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.